Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. Late last summer, three people died and more than 200 became ill after eating fresh spinach contaminated with E. coli. It was the largest outbreak of its kind ever caused by fresh produce. And it left a lot of people asking questions about America's food safety system. Well, this morning, in this hour of the show, we will talk a bit about that system, how it works, perhaps how it might be improved. And our guest is Michael Taylor. He is professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Before that, he was senior fellow and director of the Risk, Resource, and Environmental Management Division at Resources for the Future. While there, he co-founded the Food Safety Research Consortium. Going back another step, he served between 1994 and 96 as administrator of the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service. And then before that was a deputy commissioner for policy at the Food and Drug Administration between 1991 and 1994. He was also an FDA staff lawyer, an executive assistant to the FDA commissioner from 76 to 81, and also practiced food and drug law. Somebody who has quite a bit of experience in this area. And we thought it'd be a good opportunity. In fact, we've really been thinking about this now for a while. It's been on our to-do list going back to those problems that we had last summer. Would be a good thing to talk a little bit about the food safety system and what it is. And I think that he will do a good job helping us out to do that. Questions here on the program are welcome, as always. 333-9455. That's the number for here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people have questions, you're welcome to call. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible, but questions are welcome. That's why we do this show this way. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Taylor, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, happy to be with you.
This is a fairly complicated subject. I certainly have learned some things that I didn't know. I'm sure people will learn some things that they didn't know. So let's start out in a very basic way and talk about the federal agencies that are responsible for food safety. And basically, there are two, and I suppose if you add in the seafood, you end up with another one, and it may even get more complicated than that. But basically here, there are two big ones. One is the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the other is the Food and Drug Administration. And they have different kinds of responsibilities in terms of what they regulate. So perhaps we could just start out there, and I could ask the basic question, what now is the responsibilities and the difference in the responsibilities between USDA and FDA?
Well, this is a good starting point, I think, and it is just the beginning, though, of understanding a very complex system. But the Department of Agriculture and its Food Safety and Inspection Service has responsibility to inspect meat and poultry products that are produced in this country. This includes slaughter plants, but also processing plants, any plant where foods are processed that contain as little as 2% meat and poultry are subject to USDA inspection. And this is under a very traditional and longstanding approach to inspection, which requires a USDA inspector to visually inspect every carcass that goes through a slaughter plant and to visit each processing plant at least once a day. The Food and Drug Administration, on the other hand, is responsible for regulating all the rest of the food supply. When we sort of try to say how much is under USDA and how much is under FDA, we say about 20% of the food and food products are under USDA jurisdiction. Everything else is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, including seafood. There is a voluntary supplementary inspection program for seafood at the Department of Commerce, oddly enough. But the basic regulatory responsibility for seafood and everything else except meat and poultry products is at the Food and Drug Administration, which operates under a very different regulatory model. Instead of having a mandate to inspect in any particular way, FDA simply has a set of legal tools, enforcement tools, it can use to establish and enforce standards for food safety, and then it has the authority to inspect facilities where foods are processed or stored, but no particular mandate for inspection on any frequency or with any particular objectives in mind. And so while USDA operates in a very rigid, and some people think, including myself, outdated approach to inspection that consumes very substantial resources, FDA has tremendous freedom and flexibility in what it does on food safety, but relatively little resource. And roughly, while FDA regulates about 80% of the food supply, it gets about a third of the food safety resources that the federal government spends on regulation each year, while USDA regulating 20% of the food supply gets about two-thirds of the resources.
Hmm. Well, right there now, we have all sorts of opportunities to ask follow-up questions, including perhaps the most basic one, and that is, why is it that we have two different federal entities here, the USDA and the FDA, overseeing what is what some people would say is essentially one thing? We're talking about the American food supply. Why is it we have two different groups? And from time to time, and I'm sure even now, there are people who say, really, there should be one federal oversight agency doing this work, and that it doesn't make sense that it should be split the way it is. Why is it that we have two?
Yeah, well, first of all, you're correct that the expert bodies, the National Academy of Sciences, the Government Accountability Office, and others who have looked at the system do recommend that the system be unified, that this divided jurisdiction is no longer appropriate given what we know about food safety and about how to solve food safety problems. But the answer to your question about why it's the way it is really lies in history and past understandings of how food safety should be addressed. The USDA inspection program for meat and poultry really goes back a century to times when the concern with beef production mostly was that there might be diseased animals entering the food supply. It was thought, and that was thought to pose health concerns and certainly undesirable. And so the original inspection program and the first national regulatory activity for food safety really was this cattle inspection activity, which was based on eliminating diseased animals. And so it was thought of as a veterinary enterprise, and it was traditionally undertaken and originally undertaken at the Department of Agriculture, which is, of course, you know, very much involved in animal production. And that tradition has really persisted, and that focus on veterinary science and animal disease persists as a major focus of the inspection program, even though we now understand that the real food safety problems lie with the pathogens, the bacteria, the E. coli and Salmonella, Campylobacter and other pathogenic bacteria that can contaminate the food, and that certainly are not able to be detected with these visual inspection techniques. The other elements of food safety regulation were split off from USDA back during the 1930s, when the desire was to create a more health-oriented department of government and make the other elements of food inspection, you know, part of that. But the inertia, if you will, the tradition of a veterinary-based inspection program grounded in USDA has really been a large part of what's preserved this dichotomy and this separation of functions within the government.
Hmm. I think that some people might argue now, given the fact that the criticism, and we can talk some more about that, your criticism of the USDA approach to inspection and whether or not that can actually get at the real problem of foodborne illness, these kinds of pathogens, disease-causing organisms that may be contaminating the product and the stuff that you can't see them just by looking at them.
Sure.
You know, given the fact that might be a problem, I think, though, that there are some people who would point to the recent problems that we've had with fresh produce, which is under FDA, and say, well, whatever you want to say about USDA and meat inspection, we haven't the problems have been less there. It looks like they're not doing so badly, and the problems, at least we've seen recently, have been with FDA. They're the ones in charge of the fresh produce. That's where the problem is, and they don't have anywhere near the resources that USDA has. They don't apply them in the same way. So then maybe you'd have to ask a question about, well, how is FDA approaching its job? And given the job that it has it been given the resources to adequately do it?
Yeah. Well, and again, the short answer to your question of does FDA have the adequate resources to do it, the answer there is quite clearly no. This is an agency that who has seen its resources declining over the last decade, despite food safety becoming a more compelling, and more, I think, in a lot of people's minds, more important problem that needs to be addressed in a much more proactive, preventive sort of way. And, you know, the reality is that FDA's operating budget, when you know, after it pays its people, it has about $25 million, at least in the coming fiscal year budget, I think $30 million this year, as the operating budget to do all of its regulatory work for food safety and nutrition, everything from dietary supplements to infant formula to produce safety to seafood safety, and I could go on and on with a really minuscule operating budget. And that is a serious problem. But let me be clear about what it is FDA could be doing and should be doing if it had the resources. I think it is important to draw on the USDA experience. You say that USDA or that the products regulated by USDA haven't had such serious problems. Well, historically, and going back into the early 90s, many people remember the so-called jack-in-the-box outbreak of illness associated with undercooked hamburgers at a fast food chain where hundreds of children were made sick. Four children died. Due to that pathogen, which of course is the same pathogen we're now seeing in produce. Well, what worked at USDA was a reform in the system that wasn't just about more visual inspection. It was about establishing standards and criteria for controlling these pathogens and establishing a system of regulation that made it the responsibility of the companies to really understand the hazards in their system, to put in place preventive controls to prevent the hazard, and then for inspectors to closely monitor and verify that these companies were doing their food safety job. And this is a very important point because we always, when we talk about food safety, start off by talking about the government regulatory system. Well, that's just one part of the system of food safety. I mean, food is made safe or not by what people do who produce it, you know, store it, process it, market it, you know, and consume it, and the government has a critical role to play in setting standards and enforcing standards, but it really necessarily relies on the actions of people in the private sector and consumers as well. And so what USDA did that was significant was establish this understanding that it's the responsibility of the companies to put in controls that meet certain standards and for the government to enforce that. And that system, coupled with some real, you know, significant leadership and innovation within the industry, has resulted in a real decline in the problem of E. coli and ground beef. It's not a completely eliminated problem by any means, but that's a real success story. Well, FDA ideally could pursue the same sort of strategy with produce. I mean, to FDA's credit, it has established a similar system of preventive controls for seafood, but it lacks the inspection authority to really monitor, or I should say it lacks the inspection resources to really monitor that seafood safety system is being implemented correctly. And it has lacked the resources to even consider or much less develop and implement a similar approach to produce safety. And so, you know, this is why I think the issue of organizational structure and resources and how we allocate our resources to address food safety becomes critically important, because the people at FDA, the scientists there, they know how progress can be made, and they know that the system needs to be looked at in this sort of more comprehensive way and more preventive way, but they have simply lacked the resources to develop the science to put in place the specific initiatives to address major issues like produce safety.
Mm-hmm. One thing that surprised me a little bit and perhaps would surprise other people is that in terms of the tools that both agencies have, if they think there is a problem, The thing that surprises me is that neither of them, the USDA, the FDA, they have no power, no authority to order a recall of a product. Now, USDA can go in and they can shut down a plant if they think that that's a problem and that should to make a difference. But that they can't, they cannot order recalls. They rely on processors, distributors to voluntarily do that.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's is that a big problem? And is that something that if it could be done, do you think that USDA and FDA ought to be able to issue an order for a recall?
Well, I think everybody who looks at the system agrees that, that's a power that that the agency should have. At least most people would agree with that. I don't think that's their biggest problem. I think that the lack of recall authority, though, is symptomatic of the fact that the statutes under which these agencies operate, the food safety laws, are many decades old and simply, have not been updated to include some of the tools that a modern regulatory statute would naturally include, such as recall authority, such as authority to put in place civil penalties to create incentives for people to comply with requirements, surely we should modernize the statute to deal with these sorts of things, but it's equally, in fact, more important to modernize the statutes. First of all, to change the USDA's mandate for inspection so it isn't forced to put so many millions of dollars of resources and thousands of inspectors into inspection activities that the scientists would agree don't really make much contribution to food safety. We need to modernize the statutory mandate so we can be more effective in preventing problems. Recalls come into play. They're very important to correct problems after they've occurred, but we're going to achieve our food safety goals and build confidence in the system first and foremost by building in preventive measures into the system. So, again, recall is one of the gaps in the system. Interestingly, in most cases, when the government concludes that a product presents a hazard, companies have a huge public relations and economic interest in going ahead and recalling that product voluntarily, and that system generally works well. It would be good if it were backed up by the authority to require recall, but again, this is not the biggest problem in the system by any means.
Well, overall, though, do you think that given the kinds of trends that we've seen in the food industry, that is of livestock operations, for example, with very, very large numbers of animals and perhaps a smaller number of processors processing large volume of animals and meat, and perhaps also the same kind of in the produce sector, maybe the same kind of, consolidation, larger operations in terms of growing and producing. And then if you layer on top of that the fact that an increasing amount of our food comes from outside of the United States, do you think that we are headed towards more serious problems with foodborne illness than we have seen in the past?
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say that I think we can count on foodborne illness being a constant challenge and a changing challenge as those changes you just mentioned in the food system go on. And change can cut in both directions. It can make things better from a food safety standpoint and make things more difficult. I mean, the fact of that most beef slaughter and processing is consolidated in a few dozen large facilities actually, in my view, is a source of strength in the system for food safety, because these are operations that can afford the higher technologies that can be more effective in preventing problems. They can make investments in food safety that smaller operations may not be able to make, and then they become a focal point for control of the system. And so I think that's a plus. You mentioned the feedlot aspect and the large concentration of livestock at the production stage, and that clearly, on the other hand, I think is well known, raises issues about the possibility for animals to be infected and to spread infection with E. coli and other potentially harmful bacteria. And so, these changes cut in different directions. Imports present their own unique challenges, and I think some food safety challenges are very genuine when products are coming from points of production and processing where we don't have the direct oversight and where we have reason to believe that water supply and other aspects of production may not be as sanitary as it is here. And so, the way I see it, we're making progress in some areas, such as E. coli in ground beef, but we're going to see continuing challenges. And so I think it's, this is why, to me, it's important to think about the system as a whole and how we can build the system and improve the system so it can be as effective as possible over the long term. You know, we're not going to reach perfection because food production, the food system is a very human enterprise, but most foodborne illness is preventable, and we know ways to do it, and the question is how can we implement the systems to do that as well as possible.
Let me introduce again our guest, Michael Taylor. He's professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, where he does research on policy, research, and institutional issues that all affect the success of public health agencies and their carrying out their work. He was the administrator of the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service from 1994 until 1996, and before that was deputy commissioner for policy at the Food and Drug Administration from 1991 until 1994. Questions are welcome here. We're talking this morning about the food safety system in the United States, what it is, how it works, how well it works, perhaps how it might be improved. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here ready to go. The first is someone here in Champaign County where we are, and that's line one. Hello.
Good morning. Yes. I'm young enough to remember the cyanide and grape issue from Chile a number of years ago. And at this day and age that we are confronted with the possibility of terrorism, how vulnerable are the import supplies to terrorist activities that might use more sophisticated things than cyanide?
Well, I think that this is an issue that is bioterrorism that's relevant not just to imports but to the food system, at large, including domestic production. And there are vulnerabilities. There's a lot of work going on to try to protect against these vulnerabilities, including increased capacities in the federal agencies and inspection and so forth. But there's no question that the system remains vulnerable to bioterror. Hmm.
And is that here? Now we're talking about not an incidental kind of contamination that is, in a sense, kind of a natural, that may be a natural process in a way. Here we're talking about something that would be deliberate tampering, yeah. Adulteration of a product. Is this essentially the answer to that, to these two questions, is it essentially the same, or if you're talking about someone who would intentionally tamper with food, that you would have to do something different if you're really concerned about that being a problem?
Well, that is a quite a different problem in terms of the potential pathway, if you will, of the harmful agent coming into the food system. I mean, we can understand, and this is where I think we've made a lot of progress scientifically, understanding the various ways in which naturally occurring bacteria can enter the food system, whether it's from contaminated animals or lack of sanitation and processing, where people are themselves contaminating the food unintentionally because they haven't washed their hands, any number of things, and we can understand and be systematically preventive about those things. It's a very different problem with bioterrorism because, of course, the pathways are not so limited. I mean, they're subject to the imagination of a person who would seek to intentionally contaminate the food supply, and so it is a very different problem, and it has to be addressed by ways of maintaining basic security and control over food as it moves through the system. Again, protecting from access, not just from the usual sources of concern like rodents and you know, other sources of contamination we're familiar with, but again, to ingenious human intervention. So, you know, it's a real challenge, and I think it's, you know, a lot of the effort is going into being able to detect contamination of this kind when it does occur, so that if there is an incident, it can be contained very rapidly. And I think that's where a lot of good investments have been made in laboratory capacity and other techniques to be able to detect and contain these incidents should they occur.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. This is someone in Champaign, and line two. Hello.
Good morning. Where are we in the use of radiation to preserve and prevent contamination of food products?
Mm-hmm. Well, radiation is a technology that I think clearly has the ability to kill harmful bacteria and has been approved by FDA for certain purposes, some of which are you may never think of, but certain spices, for example, can be irradiated and preserved in that way and avoid contamination. A few years ago, out of response to the concern about E. coli and ground beef, FDA approved the use of irradiation for ground beef, and there were some efforts to market irradiated ground beef as with that sort of added safety feature built in. The fact is, there are a lot of public concerns, and whether well grounded scientifically or not, nevertheless, in the marketplace have translated into people not really being willing to accept irradiated ground beef. And so where it stands, I think it's fair to say, is that it is a technology that exists. It's been approved for some purposes, but its use is fairly limited at this stage. And you know, there are some cost issues. There's some there are some issues in the case, say, of ground beef of getting the right balance between applying enough irradiation to make the product safe without undercutting the quality of the product in a way that would make it simply unacceptable to people from a quality standpoint. So it's a technology with promise, but so far has not really taken hold.
Are there any technologies out there that are on the edge that we're looking at putting radiation to the side?
Yeah. Well, in beef production, actually, there have been a lot of technologies built into the slaughter and processing system to sanitize and to kill bacteria before the finished product stage. And so beef carcasses are typically subject to several sanitizing steps. They could be high-pressure steam, you know, high-temperature steam, or other sanitizing solutions. Certain natural acids are used. And so there are an array of sanitizing techniques that are used in beef production. There are also, and this is a little beyond my expertise, but there are some other technologies. High pressure, for example, can kill bacteria. And there's some, as I understand it, some applications of that technology, but not in any way that's really been widely adopted and at this stage is making a difference. You know, cooking remains the kill step of choice. And so it remains the advice, obviously, to people, even though we need to do everything we can to reduce the level of pathogens on raw meat and poultry and seafood and other raw products, you know, these products should be, you know, need to be cooked properly to protect people.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, I think that certainly people would argue that your first line of defense against foodborne illness is proper handling and making sure that things are cooked. So good hygiene in your kitchen and making sure that things are cooked. Now, then if that may not help you if we're talking about raw spinach. That's because you're not going to cook that.
And that's why fresh produce is a really challenging problem.
It's a big problem. But if you at least look at what individuals can do, if people did all that, if they did as their home ec teacher would have taught them if they ever had one, and then we looked at all those things that we know that we could do with conventional technologies in terms of processing, How far could that go towards really reducing the problem? We're not going to get rid of it, but short of an exotic technology that makes people nervous, like irradiation pasteurization, no matter what you call, they tried to find something to call it to make it seem a little bit more okay, but still people, when they hear about radioactivity, they think, and if you put that on the package, as you probably should, there are a lot of people who can look at that and say, well, I'm not going to buy that.
Right. Well, I think that's a very good question, and I think the answer is that with the technologies we have today, if we implemented them across the whole system, and it includes, of course, what consumers do, that will always be a critically important thing, that final step of food handling and preparation, whether it's in a consumer's home or in a retail food service or restaurant sort of setting. It's that, but everything else that goes that can be done all the way upstream to the point of production. If we apply the tools we've got today, the technologies today, I mean, we can go a very long way to reducing foodborne illness. And in fact, I think it's important, again, to emphasize that there is no, irradiation, even if it were fully adopted and implemented, is not a silver bullet, for food safety. There are no single-step silver bullets. We have to look at this as a systems problem that requires a systems solution and preventive steps all along the way. And so, again, if we were able to implement, what we know today, we could go a very long way in reducing foodborne illness. I mean, the starting point for me is that most foodborne illness is, in fact, preventable. Human activities contribute to it, and human activities can prevent it.
Okay, let's talk with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I just tuned in, so I apologize if you've already discussed this. I had heard that the hormones that are used that are very common in a lot of the meat and dairy products that people eat today can contribute to early onset of puberty and also to the incidence of multiple births. And I was wondering if there's any truth to that, and if there is any truth to that, if there have been any attempts to try to reduce the level of hormones that we find in our meat and dairy products to try to prevent those things from happening. And I'll listen off the air.
Okay. That's a little bit different subject. I don't know if that's something you feel that you're talk about.
Yeah, I'll say a couple of things. I mean, sure. I don't have the medical expertise, although I am at a medical school, as you said. I'm a lawyer, and I work on public policy issues affecting public health. And so, this issue of hormones used in animal production, food animal production, of course, has been a long-standing issue, and there's been controversy around it. The thing I to understand, at least the starting point, is that these hormones have to go through a very thorough Food and Drug Administration licensing process, where the safety of the hormones, as any residues remain in food, are evaluated, and FDA has to make a judgment based on substantial science that these uses are safe. Any substance, or at least most substances, that may be safe at one level may begin to present harm at higher levels of intake. And so there's always the possibility that excessive consumption intake of a hormone could have adverse effects. And I'm just very generally familiar with the literature that suggests these possibilities with respect to hormones. But I'm not aware of any conclusive evidence on that. And again, the FDA has, and this is an area where I think FDA's resources and legal tools are particularly strong, is to be able to review the safety of hormones and animal drugs, a host of products that are used in animal production and food production generally. These all have to be approved in advance by FDA, and FDA has the authority to revoke the approval if there is a food safety problem with any of these. So, but the nature of science is that new information emerges and controversy bubbles along, and I think the caller has identified one, one issue that has remained controversial, and perhaps still needing some review.
Let me introduce again our guest, Michael Taylor. He is indeed professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, but as he just said, his background is in law, and he's particularly interested in policy issues that maybe affect the success of public health agencies who are trying to do their prevention missions. He was, from 94 to 96, administrator of the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service, and also before that spent several years as deputy commissioner for policy at the Food and Drug Administration. We're talking about food safety, particularly the federal food safety system as it exists, how it works, how it tries to do its job, particularly to get at the issue of foodborne illness and how it does that and how well it's doing and perhaps how things might be changed to so that these agencies, primarily here we're talking about USDA and FDA, how they can do a better job. And again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
David, if I may just interject here.
Yes.
Talking about the food safety system, and we have talked principally about FDA and USDA, which are the major federal regulatory agencies, it is important to understand that they are just in a way, the tip of the iceberg in the food safety system. There is, at the federal level, two agencies that play an important role. One is the Environmental Protection Agency, interestingly, which is the agency that regulates pesticide residues in food, and they set the so-called tolerances or legal limits on the amount of pesticides that can be left in food. And so EPA makes hundreds of decisions every year about the safety of chemical residues in food. And then the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta is the federal agency that's responsible for surveillance of the food system and surveillance of foodborne illness, meaning they conduct regular studies and they have a whole system in place to detect outbreaks of illness and to make estimates of the burden of foodborne illness across the country. And they too are important parts of the food safety system. And I would just add, I know we want to focus on the federal level, but but each of the federal agencies, particularly CDC and FDA and USDA, and EPA as well, work very closely with state agencies. Every state has its own food safety system, often with the same sort of division of responsibilities that you see at the federal level, but sometimes with even more complexity. So that at the state level, and this is certainly the case in Illinois, there's a Department of Agriculture that looks after the health of animals as it affects food safety and looks after and it actually does some state inspection of meat and poultry, while the Illinois Department of Public Health does inspection of other food commodities and looks at processing plants. And then, of course, at the local government level, we have all the inspection that goes on of restaurants and grocery stores. So it's a very complex system, and which has real strengths in the sense that there's a substantial activity at the front line on food safety, if you will, at the state and local level that complements the federal, but it makes it an enormously difficult challenge to integrate all of this into an effective, preventive system, and that's one of the challenges that we've got.
Yeah, I think it's good that you mentioned CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's a good source. They have a website, and it's a good source for a lot of various kinds of health information and food. They have a nice section of where they look at frequently asked questions about foodborne illness.
Yep.
So if people want to learn a little bit more, they can go there. I think that one of the things that I think you have to appreciate when looking at this topic is how difficult it can be to identify that there is a problem and then to track it down. Because it's one thing if you have a bunch of people that attend a picnic and half of them get sick, well, then you know something's going on. But if you have some sort of commercially distributed food product, potentially people might be sick, but they might be in different places. And
right.
Some people might be a little bit sick, but after a couple of days, they shrug it off and they go on. Some people might be very sick and they seek out medical attention. But then if you have these isolated cases, if they're in different states or in different towns, to then collect the information, to put it together, to then think, well, there may be something that these cases have in common,
right.
And then what you to do about that, and then figure out what it is, and then trace it back. It can take weeks for something like that to happen.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because this the produce outbreak recently, the E. coli and spinach outbreak, sort of represents both the progress we've made in being able to detect problems and also the opportunity for further progress, the challenges we've got. And it's a good example of sort of how the food system has changed, that we now have these bagged spinach products that are distributed all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And as you indicated, in the context of the spinach outbreak, there were isolated cases all around the country. A few years ago, or at least a decade ago, we never would have detected that as an outbreak with a common source. It's only with CDC's new systems, which it operates collaboratively with FDA and USDA with the states, are we able to detect these outbreaks by using a molecular fingerprinting, if you will, of bacteria, so that we can match up and determine whether the bacteria that has caused an illness in one state is from the same source, is identical genetically to bacteria that are causing illness in another state. And it's that molecular fingerprinting system, the so-called PulseNet system that CDC operates, that permitted us to detect this outbreak. And again, that was very important because it did enable us to contain the outbreak more rapidly because we could understand that it had a common source, and efforts were then made to recall product and so forth. But it also is critical to discovering the cause of problems and being able to focus attention where it needs to be focused on preventing contamination in the first place. So this is real progress in the system. I mean, clearly it took a few weeks between the first illness being reported and the detection of this as an outbreak, or the understanding of it as an outbreak. And so with additional resources and improving the system, we can shorten that time frame. But it's real progress, let me assure you, that we were able to identify this as rapidly as CDC and the FDA was able to do it. That's a positive thing. And it sheds light on problems, which, again, I know concerns people because it was a big problem and it had big economic impact, but unless we are able to identify and shine light on problems, we'll never solve them. And so, again, I think this is one of the positive things that's going on, is using these better scientific tools to detect problems. Hmm.
Let's talk with a couple of other people here. Matt Toon is up next, line one. Hello.
I've got a quick question about the lawsuits against the USDA at Creekstone Farms. The USDA is not allowing Creekstone Farms to test for mad cow and those kind of things. Why would they not let them? Why would that be a problem?
Yeah. I'm not the best person to ask that question of. It is puzzling, I think, to a lot of us that companies that are responding to the market, which is what Creekstone was doing, to test product in response, I guess, to the Japanese market, were precluded from doing that. I gather, but I really don't know more about this than you and I can read in the newspaper, that USDA is concerned about losing control, really, of the testing and doing testing that some people would think is scientifically not necessary, somehow wanting to maintain control of that. But, I mean, I think the market, you know, drives a lot of activity properly, and I think that's what was going on here. And so it is puzzling. And I'm sorry, I don't have the answer. USDA is the right place to go for the answer to that question.
It was just the consumer, which in this particular case was the Japanese. They're asking for that to be done. This processor, Creekstone Farm, says we will test every single animal, and the USDA only tests a percentage of the animals, and they would not allow them to do that.
Right.
It just seems something simple to USDA. It makes me wonder who's really pushing the button.
Yeah. Right. Fair question.
Well, I think that's the best answer we can give you at this point on this show. Let's go on to Farina, and that's another caller here, I think, in line four. Hello.
Hi. About that spinach case, saw a report on the PBS NewsHour last week about it, and they showed the plant, and they talked to the owner of the farm, and he had a modern operation, and he said and I believe him. He looked like he was up to speed. They showed the spinach bath and the plant. It looked good. What did happen? How did that get contaminated? Also, I wasn't clear on that with the report, what actually, where it came from. Also, somebody told me that it was canned spinach also, and couldn't you just cook the raw spinach? Okay, thanks.
Okay. Maybe since we've referred to that case and people remember it, maybe actually earlier we should have talked a little bit about, well, what was the windup there? What was determined to be the problem?
Yeah. Well, and just we'll start with the last question first, though. Yes, I mean, cooking spinach kills the bacteria, so that is a solution. The outbreak was associated with bagged, you know, uncooked spinach, which, of course, people don't typically cook. On the question of sort of how did that story end, what was determined to be the ultimate problem, that's not been answered definitively. The most active hypothesis is that there was contamination from wild pigs, which are not uncommon in the Salinas Valley, that came into the fields and contaminated the crop that way. It's very, you know, this is why produce is a very challenging, you know, issue and needs and is, I think, beginning to get some serious research to understand, you know, how to prevent these problems, because there are so many potential pathways for the E. coli to get into the fields and to contaminate product. It originates in the intestine of animals, very commonly cattle, but other species as well, wildlife, deer, and of course the possibility of wild pigs who are present in that production area. It can be contaminating water, which can come in through flooding or use in irrigation. It can contaminate dust that can get stirred up in adjacent fields. So it's a, you know, what we're realizing is that we're, you know, obviously growing food outdoors in a very natural environment that is dynamic and that can bring this pathogen in any number of ways. And so, again, the best guess at this stage is that the source was wild pigs, but that's not definitive, and I think we'll be continuing to look at not just what happened in this case, but at the, you know, looking to the future. What are the various pathways that are most significant and where we ought to be investing resources to be preventive to keep that from happening in the future?
We're at the point here, we have 2-3 minutes left. I want to go back, and we were talking at the beginning about the two main, although there are some others, the two main federal agencies that are responsible for food safety. One is the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the other is the Food and Drug Administration, and talked about the fact that here that both of them have very big jobs because, you know, the food production system in this country is really big, and that you said that perhaps the approach of the USDA is a little outdated because it's more geared towards dealing with sick animals than it is dealing with meat that might be contaminated with disease-causing pathogens. And in the other case, the FDA, maybe they're doing a little bit better, but there they have serious resource issues. They're under-resourced. If I ask the question, well, what in both of these cases, are there some concrete things that you would say, if we could do them, would be a good thing to do to strengthen the effort that both of them do?
Well, certainly in the near term, FDA needs to get its food safety budget increased significantly, and I think there's a lot of interest in that today. I think the food industry is realizing that it's got a stake in FDA being adequately funded. I also think it's critical that we modernize the statutory mandate for both USDA and FDA so that they are directed and really held accountable for putting in place the system of preventive process controls and targeted oversight so that we're ensuring that the private sector folks who produce and market food are doing their job and meeting acceptable standards. And the final thing that I think we should do, and this is a long-term and challenging thing in our political system, but we really do need to look at, after we've modernized the statutory mandate for these agencies, unify them so that there is one entity that is responsible for food safety and for coordinating a national food safety program that is using resources effectively to target the most significant hazards and to be, you know, use the science that we've got to be as preventive as possible. And there's no one in our government who is really responsible for that today. There's no accountable official really responsible for the whole system. There's actually legislation that, now that I think of it, your Senator Durbin introduced in the Senate, a major bill last year that would do this sort of modernization of the statutory mandate and unification of the agencies, and including, a very clear mandate to, deploy the resources that are available in a way that gets the most food safety benefit, for the effort and resources expended. And I think that that legislation is a good model for how to pursue this. It's a long-term undertaking, and I think there's going to be a need for real consensus building to get to those ultimate solutions. But we do need fundamental reform, in my view, of the system in order to do as good a job as we know we can do on food safety.
Yeah, but it seems that, as you say, that the kind of reforms, those kind of reforms have been suggested before, and it seems that politically they're very difficult because I don't want to tar with too broad a brush here, but that the food industry doesn't seem to, they're not happy about additional regulation.
Well, there's divergence of views within the industry, I think. There's certainly some in the industry who resist this. There are others who see the potential value and I think might be more supportive. The agencies themselves have resisted this change. And I speak as a person who's worked at both FDA and USDA, and I have a lot of admiration for what they do and for the people who work there. But they, like any organization, people want to cling to the status quo and they want to protect their turf. And so there's been resistance at a bureaucratic level. So we do need leadership on this. And I think the concern that a lot of us have is that we'll delay making this change, and then we'll have a really serious crisis, and we'll try to make a quick change in response to crisis rather than a thoughtful way to build a system of the future. And I think, Senator Durbin's bill and other ideas that have been put forth by the National Academy of Sciences, by the General Accounting Office, the Government Accountability Office, it's now called. I mean, these are the basis for, I think, building, hopefully in a consensus way, towards a system that really will work better with the tools we've got.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. I want to thank you very much, Professor Taylor, for giving us your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Taylor is professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He is a lawyer by his training. He's interested in policy issues that have to do with how public health agencies do their work. He's a former administrator of the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service, was also deputy commissioner for policy at the Food and Drug Administration.